You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Avid Reader, a weekly broadcast here on WCHE at 5 o'clock on Mondays. As many of you know, it streams live as well, subsequently published on lots of things, Podomatic, iTunes, our bookstores, a website, Wellington Square Bookshop, our Facebook page, our Twitter, our newsletter, our YouTube channel, any other social media outlet that I can find, all of which we hope that you'll follow. In addition to these podcasts, you'll also find valuable information about the store, upcoming events, and new, rare, and exciting books of which today's book is one. Today's book is called Bulletproof Vest, subtitled The Ballad of an Outlaw and His Daughter, and it's written by Maria Venegas. It was published in June by Farrar, Straus, and Gouraud, and it's about a woman and her father. The book explores a fractured and tortuous kind of relationship that in the final analysis is about love and the different ways that it can manifest itself in our daily lives and in the lives of our closest relatives and sometimes our closest friends. Jose Venegas, Maria's father, is a true Mexican outlaw, complete with a history including the eponymous bulletproof vest, guns, rifles, murders, fights, car accidents. He's essentially, figuratively, and literally bulletproof. And his life is riddled, no pun intended, with anger, violence, revenge, retribution, and pain. Many kinds of pain. His Americanized, and I don't like that word, but all the reviewers use it, his Americanized daughter, Maria, our guest, is in many ways like him and in many ways his polar opposite. The juxtaposition of these qualities is what gives the book its veracity and its compelling nature. In fact, halfway through, I still wasn't sure I was reading a memoir instead of a novel. Maria was born in the state of Zacatecas, Mexico, and immigrated illegally to the United States when she was four. The book was excerpted early in Granta and The Guardian, and also translated into Spanish. Maria's short stories have also appeared in Plowshares, and she received her MFA from Hunter. Thanks for joining us today, Maria.
Thank you for having me.
So, I guess basically the first question would be why, when, how did this come about?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, just during your introduction, I heard you mention something about how even though it's a work of nonfiction, but it reads like a novel.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me, originally, you know, I didn't have a relationship with my father for 14 years, during which time I had no contact with him and was ambivalent to whether he lived or died. But then I did, after 14 years, I went back to Mexico to visit him. And he was living on the same ranch in Zacatecas, Mexico, where both he and I were born. And so after my initial visit, I returned and spent a few summers and holidays with him. And, you know, we would go out, he would saddle up the horses, and we'd ride out to the ranch that it was a good four-hour horseback ride, and we'd set out at, like, 4 a.m., and, you know, he started sharing stories with me. It was sort of this, through my spending time with him in this land, in this area where he had been raised, we would ride past a tree or a creek or something, and that would spark some story. And he'd say, you know, this is where my brother Antonio and I ran into Fidel, and they exchanged words, pulled out their guns, and shot at each other. And it was through these stories that he started to share with me, and it was in stories of when he was 12 years old and his mother handed him his first gun, that I really became interested in what made him tick. And so I think I initially started to write the stories maybe as a way to understand him. And originally, I think also I really wanted to write. I wanted to write like a book-length corrido about his life, and I really wanted to write a work of nonfiction based on these stories he was sharing with me that would read like a novel because the material really lends itself to a novelistic approach. And there is a lot of violence and brutality, but I also think that I tried to There's also, I think, a lot of very comic sort of moments, you know, because enough time has passed that that it is sometimes, it's just sort of, I guess that's how tragedy is, you know, when time has passed and you look back, sometimes you can start to see the comedy in it.
Yes.
So even though there is a lot of violence in the book, I do think that there are very sort of maybe lighthearted moments. It's okay to laugh.
Yeah, it's like you say in 2 years we'll laugh about this, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's that sort of thing. I feel like it's okay to laugh, and also I'm very happy to hear you say that you had to stop and check yourself and be like, well, am I reading a novel? What am I reading?
Well, that would be the biggest question I would ask you, because if it was a novel, it's clear I could ask you this question, because I think every reader would. Mm-hmm. You say almost with vitriolically, you know, I hate my father, he's dead to me. Some things that are almost a clear end of a relationship. That's what it was. The relationship had ended. And then the relationship is recreated, albeit slowly. So the reader would ask, what is this, du es eshmasana, what is this that allowed her to move from this spot to this spot? What was it that allowed you to let your father back into your, not only your life, but into your psyche? He was gone.
Well, it was, I think, a number of things. Like the very first time I went to visit my father in Mexico, I sort of had this attitude like, okay, fine. I mean, the man that I was dating at the time, he convinced me to go back. And he was very sweet and funny about it, you know, because he said, you know, your old man, he's still alive. You can go across the border and go see him. There's people out there that don't ever get that opportunity again for whatever reason. They were estranged from their parents, and, you know, then the parent passes away, and they're never given that opportunity, which is really sad. So he, you know, he was kind of like, your father's still there. You really should go visit him, because someday all of this anger that you have towards him is going to come out. And he said, and guess who's going to be on the receiving end of it? And pointed at himself. You know, so it, he definitely had a lot to do with convincing me to go back initially. And so that first visit for me, I sort of thought, you know, I'll just go back and I'll see the old man, kind of look him in the eye and be done with it. And I probably won't ever talk to him again. But my father ended up, we spent, I think, 3 days with him. And one of those days we rode out to his ranch, which really was sort of this eye-opening, sort of amazing journey within itself, to set out at 4 a.m. in the dark, under the starlight and the moonlight, and ride out there. And it's just so peaceful and solitary and quiet. And it was, I don't know, I sort of started to see him in this different light. But also when he drove us to the bus the day that we did leave and dropped us off at the bus station, when I hugged him goodbye, his chin started quivering. And his eyes glazed over, but it happened so fast because, you know, he, of course, snuffed that emotion out so fast that just as quickly as it came, it was gone. But it was even just the sight of the fact that he almost, just that display of emotion.
Yeah.
I think really sort of, it kind of broke something in me. And it made me realize, it was like, you know, he, for as much as I did think that he was this bulletproof man and indestructible, and he really, it caused me to become empathetic toward him, I guess. And when I did go back and started spending time with him, it was a slow journey, really. And you know, and through his sharing these stories of his own upbringing and the way that he was raised, I just started gaining more insight into why he did the things that he did and why he had lived such a violent and self-destructive life. And it was really, and also through the writing, you know, I mean, really through sort of writing these stories that he shared with me, there's a saying that sometimes, you know, even when you're writing a novel, writing is kind of like driving through the fog. You don't really know where you're going until you get there, but you just have to keep going. Or also when you're writing, sometimes maybe you don't really know you make discoveries in the writing that you wouldn't otherwise. And so I feel like for me, I really sort of gained this deeper understanding of my father and how he was raised and how he was wired and why he did the things that he did through writing about him. And that really, and because of that, I became empathetic towards him until over the years I really learned to love him.
You know, the truth of what you're saying in the book really comes through, and I think the reader recognizes that very clearly. I know I did. But then if you go back to this idea of it being novelistic in terms of, it confuses the reader, which is good. I think readers should be confused from time to time. But what's really really interesting is that the reader is dragged along with you on this journey. And and me as a reader, I'm thinking to myself, you know, he really was a bad guy. I mean, he really did some horrible things. I'm really surprised. I know her siblings went down. I know this guy is going to take her down. I'm really, really surprised that she's doing it. And so the reader's thinking, oh, man, this guy's such a villain that it's almost impossible to believe that she was willing to do it. But your last answer explained it perfectly. And then the other thing, and I want to go back a minute, is I'm always interested in dedications and epigraphs. And your dedication is Para mi querido viejo, which means what?
Para mi querido viejo.
Sorry. Yes. Told you I'd do that. So that means, is it for my old man, like, or is it?
It's for my beloved old man.
Okay. And then the epigraph, and I know you love Faulkner. Mm-hmm. And so the epigraph is from Late in August, which is one of the books kind of like your Desert Island books. And the epigraph is, and this confused me a little bit, it's no wonder that I had no father and that I had already died one night 20 years before I saw light, and that my only salvation must be to return to the place where my life had already ceased before it began. Mm-hmm. I can kind of understand it.
Right. you know, that's actually, it's a quote from Light in August, and it's a memory that's being filtered through the main character, Joe Christmas. And I think when I read Light in August and I found this Joe Christmas character, I was really drawn to him for a number of reasons, because, you know, we meet him at the beginning of the novel, and you kind of can tell that there's something off about him and there's something rootless about him. But you don't know what it is, and he doesn't even really know what it is, and he's not even in touch with his own roots or where he comes from. He knows that at some point he was adopted by a foster. Well, anyway, so he doesn't exactly know, but then, like, about halfway through the book, we get his backstory and find out that he was in an orphanage and adopted by a foster family, raised under a very brutal religious upbringing. And because of that, you sort of start to understand what's making him tick. But that quote comes from this sort of inner monologue that he's having. And it resonated with me, especially because I think, you know, the book, yes, it is the story. It's the story of a reconciliation between a father and a daughter. But for me, it was also about going back to Mexico and reconnecting with my roots. And when I was, and I really didn't know too much about Mexico before I went, certainly not the Mexico where I had been born, the actual state and the old hacienda and that desert and those mountains where I had come from. I didn't really know anything about it. But also, what happened is when I was 2 years old, my parents left for the U.S. to find jobs, and then, you know, they were going to send for my four sisters and I a few months later, and then that ended up taking 2 years. So I was separated from my parents from the time I was two until I was four. And then, you know, my grandmother actually told me the story of how, after they had left, I asked about them every single day because I was only 2 years old and I didn't understand what was happening, until eventually she was so fed up with my waking up and asking about my parents that she took me back to La Peña, which is the place where my father and I were both born and where he was living when I went back to visit him. So she took me back there one day and said that once I walked into the house and realized that they weren't there, never again did I ask about them, but I also stopped talking for 2 weeks. just like it completely wiped my language away. And so I, when she told me that story, it was really heartbreaking for me to hear it and to also process the fact that I had gone through this very traumatic thing that I had no recollection of.
Well, then,
and how, so, in, yes?
I was just going to say, given that, how did it feel? I mean, it was poignant in the book. How did it feel the moment you went back into the room in which you were actually born, when you went back there?
You know, I think it's not even just the room. It's the fact that the room is there, the house is still there, and it's still intact. And La Peña and the ranch up in the mountains, like, that whole terrain in itself is pretty intact, and it has been for generations because, you know, it's land that my great-grandfather purchased and passed on to my grandfather and then passed it on to my father. So it wasn't even just, it was just the whole experience of just being back in that land and the house. And actually, and walking into that room was, it kind of feels like, it felt like walking into a time capsule, walking into that room. You know, the bed where I was probably born is still, the mattress is gone, but the like old rusty bed frame was still in the corner, and it's, you know, it was being used as storage. So it was just old harnesses and donkey saddles and things just being stored there. But it's sort of, for the most part, the whole, the house and the land itself is as it's been for years. And so it really, it felt like traveling back in time and also entering some sort of time capsule.
Yeah, I can see
it was a very, it was really amazing.
You know what I really liked was the fact that each time you came, you would take something away, like the donkey saddle or the yeah. ball. And I really like the way your father was saying, how do you think you're going to get that back without it breaking? And then you're just holding it on your lap, which I would never do, but you did, right?
But I did. Well, I felt like there was no other way because it was this huge clay jug is what it was. And, you know, there was really, I felt no other way to get it back, but I really wanted it in my apartment in Brooklyn. And I have all of those things in my apartment now, and it does. Friends will come over, and they think that it's reclaimed stuff from an antique store or a flea market or something. And then I'm like, no, actually, that wooden saddle, I used to ride around on that when I was little. You know, like when we used to go up to the ranch for the rainy season, my parents would saddle up the donkeys, and we'd all go out there and spend the rainy season out there, and us kids would ride on the donkey saddles.
Who owns the property now?
My siblings and I do.
Really? Oh, that's the other thing that's cool. It's like your dad, one of the interesting parts is when you're talking about, well, first of all, it was really cool that your dad got to read and when someone translated it for him, stories about himself from Granta. I think that was amazing. And also the fact that you say, you know, he's down there saying, hey, that's cool that you made some money when he has so little. And what you're saying is your siblings have all done very well for themselves. And have they, are your siblings all still successful people that are, you know, doing well in the world?
Yes, I would say so. And, you know, I guess that's the beauty of the American dream, as they say. I think my older siblings are all turned out to be very entrepreneurial, and they all have their own businesses. Like two of my sisters own a chain of beauty salons.
Mm-hmm.
And then my one brother, he's a contractor. He's a self-taught contractor. And at some point he was building million-dollar homes. I know he built a home, I want to say, for one or two of the Bears players in the Chicago area.
Yeah, it was in the book, too. You talked.
Right,
I forgot
right.
who you said he was building. He was going to live
so
with.
So he was building these really beautiful million-dollar homes. And then my other sister has her own mortgage company. So they sort of took a hit when the crash happened in 2008.
Right.
But they've recovered and they're doing fine, you know. And I've written this book, and I guess it took me a while to find my way. The interesting thing also is that I was the first one in my family to go to college. So they, I think, were all sort of, you know, after college I decided to pursue acting even though I studied economics.
Yeah, the acting part. What happened with the acting? Because it sounded like you were really, when you were getting those callbacks from HBO and stuff like that, I was really curious and interested in that.
Right. I know. I felt like I was right there at the door too for a while. But Honestly, I think it's some point along the way between all of the auditioning and, you know, for the one thing that you do book, you're rejected maybe 10, 15, 20 times. So it starts to take a toll. And but aside from that also, I was writing the whole time that I was acting. And at some point I realized that I was doing too much. I was working in the fashion industry in New York full time, and then I was taking acting classes in the evenings and going on auditions and taking writing classes in the evenings. And it just, at some point, I think I sat down and had a conversation with myself, and it was like, okay, you know, we really can't do it all, so we're going to have to decide what it is we want to focus on. And I think it really kind of, at that point, if the writing felt more important, I felt like it was more important for me to focus on writing and to keep going with that.
That's interesting, too, because it's interesting in the book how your mother is so against the concept of you going to college and why, and so afraid that you're not going to, afraid of being in the crowd that she doesn't want you to be in and doing things that she doesn't want you to do. That must have been difficult also.
It was difficult, but, you know, I had the amazing ability of tuning my mother out
yeah.
at that moment in my life when I was in high school and just decided that I was going to do what I was going to do. And also, you know, my mother, I mean, of course, her advice was given to me under the assumption that I was going to graduate from high school. If that, you know, I mean, at some point she wanted me to drop out of high school and get a job at Kmart as a cashier, because then someday I might be promoted to manager. So, you know, I don't blame my mother for that, and I also don't think that it's ignorance. It's just because of the way she was raised, you know, she didn't really know any better. Or she, whatever advice she was giving me, it was influenced by the way that she'd been raised, and she'd been born and raised in Mexico, and, you know, the women, it certainly from whatever area rural part of Mexico she was in, you know, women get married young and have kids, and then that's their lot in life, their housewife. So I had already decided I didn't want to be a housewife and that I was going to go to college and get an education. So I wasn't really listening to my mother at that point.
Yeah, it's like there was part of your father in that, the way you acted then. You could almost see that a little bit, you know, that you were going to do what you were going to do and no one was going to stop you in doing it. But, you know, that that goes to the fact that this is literally and figuratively kind of like an open book. You say mm-hmm. a lot of things about your life that are intimate and that are seem like they would be really hard to talk about, but you do, in pretty, you know, mm-hmm. plain language.
Right.
Was it hard?
Well, it was, you know, there are, as I said, because there is so much violence in the book, you know, my brother was murdered. There's just so much violence and hardship.
Well,
but
things did happen to you too.
Exactly. Well, I know that there was the chapter, I think maybe it's called The Basement, and it deals with my having been raped when I was in high school. And I wrote that chapter. Actually, you know, I think that's the only chapter in the entire book that's written in second person.
Right.
And because all the other chapters sort of jump back and forth between first person and third person, my perspective and my father's perspective. But that particular chapter, that scene, it was a very difficult scene for me to revisit and write about. And initially, I think I wrote it in first person, and I really didn't like the tone of it. I tried, and it just didn't work. Because I think in writing it in first person, I wasn't letting myself really kind of get to the root of the whole experience. And then when I tried writing it in second person, that's when it really clicked. And I think just writing it in second person enabled me to remove myself enough from it so that I could write it, I guess, maybe with a bit more clear-sighted. But you know, it's interesting because I think there was some review came out. I'm not sure what publication it was in, but somebody, the critic, somehow it bothered him that I had written this. I think he said something along the lines of, I don't understand why anybody would write about being raped in second person. Like, it makes no sense. And I was just sitting there thinking, really? That doesn't make sense to you? It seems pretty obvious to me.
Yeah, it does.
Why somebody would do that. But, well, to each their own, I guess.
Well, no, I was working out this morning, and one of the instructors said that they had listened at a gym to someone telling somebody that when you run, you should only breathe through your nose, never breathe through your mouth. And I wanted to say, no, that's completely wrong. You want air, you want oxygen, you want to breathe through your mouth. And it's kind of like, yeah, this is important that you let this go. And I can understand the second person is kind of, it's kind of a protective thing in one sense. But I think it gives you a lot more insight into what happened than if you try to explain it. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
In first person. Yeah. Well, it allowed me to remove myself just enough from the whole experience so that I could actually get the whole thing out.
Exactly.
And I wrote it, and I wasn't even sure if it would be a part of the book when I initially wrote it. But then, as I continued to write the book, it made sense to leave it to have it be a part of the book because. And that's another thing that I sort of discovered later when I reconnected with my father and we'd go out and herd cattle. And there happened to be one cow that had a calf, and the calf kept wandering into the thorny brambles. And then my father was like, that cow, she's so distracted. She's more preoccupied with trying to keep up with the herd that the wolves are probably going to end up getting her kid. Because she would just ignore it and it would wander off on its own and she's running behind the herd. And then I just remember having that moment of, right, like, that's what happens when you're a kid and you're growing up and, the father's gone and your mother's not paying attention. Or when the parent's not paying attention, the wolf gets the kid.
Right.
And so I don't explicitly say that in the book, but I think the implication was there. And
it was.
It seemed important. It seemed like an important chapter.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes metaphors, again, the reader is able to discern the metaphor even if it's not tied with the actual fact.
And right, there is that whole trust your reader.
Yeah.
that's something that was drilled into me in the writing program. I got my MFA at Hunter, and it was the show don't tell was the one thing, and then the trust your reader. It took me a while, that took me a while to figure it out, but I think...
Well, yeah, but and like I said, it's really hard the way you did it because I swear to God, and before reading about it, I got the book and just started reading. And I thought, oh, this is an interesting novel. But then I couldn't believe it was nonfiction because there were so many incredibly weird things that happened. It's like I couldn't believe this car riddled with bullets. And when you do your preface, it's like riddled with bullets, he's dead. But then there were conflicting stories. It's like, okay.
Right.
this guy's dead.
Right.
He's definitely
dead. Well, and I think people read books for a number of reasons. They read books to get insight into different cultures or maybe just for sheer entertainment reasons. And I think also for me, writing the book so that it would read more like a novel, for me as a writer, was a bit more of a challenge, but it was also more engaging that way.
Definitely.
To sort of recreate some of these stories that my father had shared with me, to just recreate them as these scenes from his perspective, that was more engaging. And I had fun with it. It was really difficult. My father actually, he died 6 months after I sold the book. He died in a very awful, brutal, unexpected way. But I had to finish the book, so it was emotionally very difficult for me, but it was also cathartic, and I had fun with it. I had fun with it wherever I could.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned the word, the corrido. Am I pronouncing it right again? Corrido? Corrido? Corrido.
Corrido. That's close enough.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Sorry.
So you talk about that. Is this, why don't you tell our listeners what that is and what it means in Mexico to a person to have that written, and your brother.
Right. Well, a corrido, it's a pretty long-standing form, and it's a music, it's a ballad, and it's a pretty long-standing tradition in Mexico, and, so usually a corrido is written about a person after the person has died to commemorate their life, and traditionally it'd be like a war hero or maybe some bandit. The corridos always have tragic endings, and they usually end when the hero dies. That's the end of their corrido. When I started to write the book, my father was still very much alive and well. When I was writing, I was pretty much halfway through the writing of the book, and I wasn't exactly sure of what the ending would be, or what I was writing toward. But then after he died, I felt like, oh well, that's got to be the ending.
Right.
You know, I sort of always thought, like, I wanted to write a book-length corrido about his life, because to try and put everything that happened to him and everything that he did, and it's just, it would have been way too much to try and put it all in a ballad. So it made sense to write a book about his life.
It's interesting, too, because he constantly in the book alludes to it in all kinds of different situations where that would be the end of this corrido. And then after mm-hmm. his death, he actually attempted to write his own, did he not?
He did. He actually had, and this is something that's not keeping with tradition, he had gone and had some musicians write his corrido for him. And then he even went and had it notarized at a public notary to sort of make it official, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And I had no idea that he had done that until after he died, because he had the corrido and the rough drafts in this green trunk in his bedroom with like old land deeds leading back. I think those were dating back to late 1800s, and love letters that women had sent him when he was in prison, and it was just all these documents and every single court document, you know, every single time he had gotten to court for. I think, well, there was the murder of my uncle. He had all the court documents for that, for the murder of my brother. And so, and all of that stuff, I feel like when I found that, all those documents in the trunk, it was sort of like finding a treasure trove. Because at that point, he was dead, and I couldn't confirm certain things with him. So I kind of had to just take whatever stories he had already shared with me, these documents I found in the trunk, and then I had my grandmother and my mother to sort of, you know, ask for certain details, but that stuff that I found in the trunk was really sort of invaluable in the finishing of the book.
That's interesting. You know, it's funny now when an American thinks mm-hmm. about a corrido, it's like, okay, well, my father was a CPA, and, you know, mm-hmm. he doesn't get one. But then think of someone like... Think of someone like Steve Jobs, who had this life which was amazing and then died somewhat tragically. Are there mm-hmm. still people that can have... Is it still a world in which corridos can still be written? Obviously you did, but are there people that about whom you think that still works?
In Mexico or just in the world at large?
The concept.
You know, I think probably you could write a corrido about anybody, really. It's kind of like you could write a story about anyone and make it interesting. So I get, if you wanted to write a corrido about your father, the CPA, I think you could pull it off.
Well, you know, it's funny. My daughter now says something is a true fact. And mm-hmm. I say, well, a fact is a fact, but I understand what she's getting at. And so like, if mm-hmm. I asked you about the book, is everything in it a true fact?
Well, you know, the stories that my father shared with me were obviously recreations of his own memory. So you know, it's memory. It's tricky.
It is.
I mean, whatever story my father might have remembered in a certain way, somebody else might tell that exact same story and from a completely different point of view.
Like your mother.
Exactly. But you know, the stories. As far as I know, the stories he shared with me. I mean, everything is true in the sense that everything happened. You know, the emotional truth was my father's emotional truth. Is that factual? I don't know, but I really, because I wanted to write the story of his life, I wanted to stay as close to his emotional truth as possible. And even my own memories are, you know, I think I have a photographic memory, and then I'd write something down and maybe ask one of my siblings about it, and they'd be like, no, that's not the way it happened at all. It happened this way, and we all have a different version of the same event. But the event is factual. The event actually took place. We just all remember it a little differently.
Well, it's funny. In your father's story of his life, it's very interesting the way he doesn't regret anybody that he's killed except mm-hmm. for your uncle. And mm-hmm. what's interesting in that scene is the fact that, you know, the way he takes his hat off and puts it on his head, but then he has this moment of hesitation before he does it, but and I don't know if this is type of machismo or what it is, but he had no choice because he had already committed himself. Is that
right?
Is that really the way you? I mean, is it just again? It was like a novel. It was like here he is with his gun pointed at this person's head. Should I do it? Shouldn't I do it? I have no choice. I have to do it. I've come this far.
Right. That particular scene was between the basement scene and that scene. I think those were probably the two most difficult scenes to write. And it was really hard. I feel like I actually wrote that scene sort of looking away from the page and cringing the whole way because it was such an atrocity and it was such an awful thing that he did. And in pulling the trigger, I mean, for me, when we got the news that he had shot my uncle and killed him, for me, I felt like, you know, that same bullet that killed my uncle also killed my father. And it was from then on that I was really just done with him.
Yeah.
But yes, that was a very difficult scene for me to write. But I also, you know, it was important. I felt that it was important. Like if I was going to write this, sort of paint this portrait of this man, I had to show all of the different layers. Like it had to be the good, the bad, and the ugly.
You know, the other way you exposed yourself a lot was with you obviously loved your deceased brother very, very much, and he loved you. And then the manner of his death wasn't caused by your father. Well, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. But the point of it is that must have been very difficult for you, too, and it must be still. In fact, I almost thought that you would dedicate the book to your brother.
Yeah, I thought about it, but I think for a long time I thought I would dedicate the book to both my father and my brother. But then after my father died, it seemed that it really needed to yes, there is so much of losing my brother and dealing with that loss in the book. But I think for the most part, I was really trying to tell my father's story.
Well, as you said, your book is his song. And what's also interesting is that your brother also had your father commissioned his Querido, correct?
Yes, I know. I can't find a copy of it anywhere.
I was going to ask you that. That's too bad.
That's too bad. But he had a Querido written for my brother to sort of commemorate his life. And, you know, and then that when I was a kid and growing up, that was kind of torturous, too, because he would play this song, this ballad of how my brother had been killed in Mexican mountains. I mean, I grew up being afraid of Mexico. Like, I grew up it sort of felt like Mexico was this dysfunctional, distant relative that I never wanted to meet because it just felt like this, like everybody that went back to Mexico never returned. You know, I sort of felt like if I were ever to go back to Mexico, the land itself might just open up and swallow me alive. It felt dangerous in some way, and so for many years I really had no interest on going back there. But you know, when I did, I discovered things. It goes back to that Faulkner quote about, you know, having sort of died in a way in this place 20 years before you saw light. It just that quote really resonated with me because I felt that my umbilical cord is buried in that front yard of the house where I was born. And the very traumatic experience that had happened to me there when I was 2 years old, or even just all of those memories of Mexico before I left when I was four, I didn't remember them. And it wasn't until I went back there that I discovered this huge piece of my own past.
How do you feel about it now? Do you still go back?
You know, I didn't go. After my father died, I went back for the funeral, which was really difficult. And sadly, at that point, the drug cartels had completely taken over the town where he was living in. So it really, you know, it was really, I never thought I would be in a position where I went back there and one of my father's acquaintances came and found me at the wake and was basically warning me to be careful of who I talk to and what I say, and to sort of maybe just my sisters and I should try and take care of whatever needed to be taken care of and get out of town as fast as possible, and maybe go stay in a hotel. And it felt so lawless, and it was just such an intense experience that I felt like it's like you I didn't even have time to mourn my father because I was so preoccupied with looking over my shoulder.
Hey, why don't you talk a little bit about that? One of the most interesting portions of the book, I think. Talk about the SUVs and the Humvees and the ransom a little bit, if you want to.
I think the irony, and I hate to give away that I'm like, spoiler alert.
No, don't do it.
No.
Nah, because it was fascinating. Because the questions I would ask, I just want to
Away those final chapters.
If we were in the room alone, yes, I would definitely ask them. But sometimes I forget that there are listeners, and I'm just so curious about things. But
that haven't read the book. But yeah. I do think that it's when I was spending time with my father, kidnappings had been taking place for 2 or 3 years in other parts of Mexico, but that violence just hadn't reached the state of Zacatecas. And it is slightly ironic that 53, I think it was in May of 2009, I want to say, that 53 inmates escaped from the Zacatecas Federal Prison. And within 5 minutes, 53 inmates had escaped, driven off in these SUVs that came to pick them up. Not a single shot was fired. So, of course, people started to speculate that the government or the prison guards and the feds must have been in on it, because how else was it possible for all these inmates to escape and not a single shot to be fired? And it was really after that prison break that the cartels started to move into the state of Zacatecas and into my father's town. And everything changed. I will say that I find it's a little ironic that the same prison where he had spent 4 years for murder and then was bailed out by his parents, it's from that same prison that these cartels that came in and took over his town and really ended up, it's like my father he was an outlaw. And while I would never justify anything that he did, I think he found a way to justify the things that he did. Or he still thought that he was living, and he was living by a certain old code, like an eye for an eye. If somebody murders your son or your brother, you get revenge, and that's it. And the law has nothing to do with it. And that was sort of his attitude. And it's kind of ironic that then these cartels start moving in, and they had no code. There was no rhyme or reason for the things that they did. They just, it was like a pack of wild wolves coming down from the mountains.
But then again, when your father was imprisoned, your grandmother said, hey, don't worry about it. We have money. And mm-hmm. It was almost like, I don't mean to say it this way, it's not the same situation, but it was like, we can get you out because there's corruption, and if we have enough money, we can get you out, which is how he got out.
That's the sort of, this is like in Mexico, it's sort of been that way for many years, where if you murder somebody, you could potentially be bailed out for a couple $1,000s. The man that murdered my brother, I think he spent maybe a total of 9 months between prison and a mental institution that they eventually transferred him to. But it was a total of 9 months behind locked doors before his family bailed him out. And from what I hear, it was maybe they paid some $2,000.
Yeah, that's a very interesting.
Something like that.
That's a very interesting story, too. Especially.
Yeah, and because the federal system, because unfortunately it is so corrupt that's why I think for generations, men have always, and it's usually men, I mean, sometimes I suppose the women, but it's usually the men that take the law into their own hands and they make their own justice.
Yeah, exactly, with him too. And what was really interesting talking about true facts is that your father tells the story about what happened to the gentleman who killed your brother, and you're kind of like thinking, I wonder if this is really the way it happened or not. Right?
Right. Yeah, and I think out of all the stories he shared with me, that was the only one that I was kind of like, I don't know. That sounds like it sounded to me like he was recounting a story as it was told to him, rather than something that he had actually witnessed. I'll never know. Once I sold the book, I started a list of questions that I wanted. I wanted clarification.
And you're like
I had
me.
Planned. I was going to sit down. I was going to go back there and sit down with him. I wasn't going to tell him that I sold the book because I didn't want him to embellish anything, and I didn't want that to influence whatever information he shared with me in any way. But I did start a list of questions that I wanted clarification on. And, you know, like that was one of, like, did you or did you not kill this man that killed my brother? Although I think it would have been, really, and he ended and he died. So I never got the chance to clarify these things. So I just had to, take the information that I had already been given and make the best, best with it.
Because as a reader and reading it, if it was a novel, I made up my story. I know what your father did. So isn't that funny? I mean, I know exactly what happened. I could paint it. I could see.
Oh my God!
Right
what
now.
Happened? Can you please tell me what happened? Because I'm still not sure.
What I think happened is he may have hired those guys, and he may not have hired those guys. But there's no question that he walked through the door, and there's no question that he made sure that he knew who he was, and he made him sit there and look at him in the eye. And then he put the bullet where he usually put the bullet. That's what happened in my head. And that's what really happened, I think.
There you go. Thank you. You're welcome. You for clarifying that.
Well, anyway, that's a good time to end it, I guess, because we've been talking for almost 50 minutes. I have tons of questions, but you're going to keep doing spoiler alert, so I can't ask you anything else.
I did an interview with the BBC in July, and then the woman, I think out of nowhere, was like, and then, you know, towards the end of the book, your father dies in a car accident, and I was like, ah!
I know, I can't believe people do that.
So why would you give that away? You know?
I know, sometimes I'll read stuff in Kirkus or even in the Times, and I'm going, you know, they really probably shouldn't have said that, you know? It does give away way too much, and you know that changes things. But
right, because for me, the choice that I made to reveal to the reader, you know, that eventually my father does die at that same curb where he's ambushed at the beginning of the book. That's a choice that I made to let the reader know that eventually he's going to die at that curb, because there are so many other times that curb.
Oh yeah,
is in different scenes. And so, you know, so I would hope that that information would resonate with the reader.
Have they fixed that curve?
I'm sorry?
Have they fixed that curve?
Well, there's really nothing about it to be fixed. I mean, it's been there forever. And, you know, and not that and cars don't usually fly off that curve, because people that grew up around it there are aware that it's there.
And they go 20 miles
and
an hour.
It's really not a dangerous, massive curve either. It's actually a pretty subtle curve, but if you take it going 90 miles an hour, you might be in trouble.
Yeah, and there's
but you know, that was a choice I made to let the reader know that eventually the feds do find him at the foot of a mesquite at that same curve, but I didn't want to say how exactly he died.
No,
and I think that it adds to the tension.
Yeah, it does, like with the thorns. I mean, that was well done too. Just now I'm going to go into the spoilers. Okay, that's it.
Okay.
We're done. all right, well, so it was great. I don't know what your next venture will be, but if it's a novel, I'm really looking forward to it and hope then we can talk again. And if you're ever in the area, where my bookstore is, which is just outside of Philadelphia, if you could come by and do a signing or Skype with our book club, because I'm sure they'll be picking this book as a book. So.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, we can be in touch about that. I have a very good friend in Philadelphia that I would love to go and visit, so I can use this all as an excuse and just come out there for a weekend trip or something. That would be great.
I would love it. That would be great. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Maria Venegas, who was talking to us about her father. Like I said, I thought this was a novel, and didn't know it was a memoir, and it turns out it was amazing life. Both of theirs are amazing. And I know Maria is doing really good work now in New York and Brooklyn. We should have talked about Brooklyn, because she talks a lot about how it changed from what she remembered and what it is now, which is kind of Disney-fied. So anyway, next week, and this is back to the kind of people I like and we've been interviewing a lot of lately, it's Theodore Gray. He's going to discuss his new book, which is Molecules, The Elements and Architecture of Everything. And it's one of those few books remaining that you really can't download on a Kindle or an iPad, because there's so much illustration and so much kind of three-dimensional pictures of, essentially, he demonstrates how the element, and he's written books about this before, how the elements of the periodic table combine to form the molecules that make up virtually everything in our world. And so it's a combination of chemistry and physics and kind of the theory of everything. And that's the kind of thing I like to talk about. So I'm really looking forward to talking to Theodore Gray next week regarding his book, Molecules, the Elements and Architecture of Everything. Thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader. And I look forward to you being here with us next week.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.